the first days of school. If you have not been around this book, get yourself around it. It is likely that if you spend 45 minutes with this book rather than 45 minutes in this class, you will be more prepared. I'm serious. This book is just that potent. You can open it anywhere and browse. It invites browsing. You don't have to read it from front to back. Here's a little text box I'd like to read to you. And in fact, I'd like you to help me read it. You're bright-eyed here this afternoon, and I think you will know how to help me read it when we get to that point. The most important words, the three most important words to a painter, pilot, or chef are, you ready to help? Preparation, preparation, preparation. The three most important words to a teacher are preparation, preparation, preparation. And now he focuses on one area, preparation, and says a cluttered or barren room sends a negative message to your pupils. A well-organized, attractive room gives an in-control image that students respect. It is imperative that you have your room ready and inviting before the students enter it on the first day of school. Now, starting more broadly than just room preparation. Not so long ago, I was reading in Psalm 51. Psalm 51 is the one that begins, "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness, blot out my transgression," and so on. It's a psalm of repentance. Verse 1 talks about sensing a need for mercy. Verse 2 talks about being washed and cleansed. Verse 3 talks about being honest with your mistakes. And by the way, the president that we have right now said I never needed to apologize because it was never wrong. Verse 6 talks about desiring truth in the inward parts. It desires truth as an inward plumb line. Verse 8, we have these things starting popping up that talk about joy and rejoicing. And verse 10 talks about a right spirit. And then in verse 13, he just sort of bursts forth with something very close to our consideration today. He says, "Then will we teach." No, that's not all he says. But he says, "Then will I teach transgressors thy ways, and sinners shall be converted unto thee." It suggests a heart preparation. Preparing heart, preparing prayer is the first thing we're going to talk about just a bit this morning. Listen to this quote, and I want this to grip you. I want you to grip it, both directions. Teachers impact more by their character and commitment than by their communication. Teachers impact more by their character and commitment than by their communication. And here we thought we were going to be a teacher. We thought we were going to communicate. And if we communicate well, our job is done well. Well, that is not all false. That certainly is correct. But what's going to teach more than that are your character and your commitment. That would teach more than your direct communication. That comes from Bruce Wilkinson. I'll be reading more from his book, The Seven Laws of the Learner. He's a good author to read, has inspired me a lot. But does that concept grip you? Does it scare you a little bit? It scares me. And I think the reason it scares me is because I know my character isn't quite what it should be. I know my commitment isn't quite what it should be. I know myself just a little bit too well. And here we go into leadership on that premise, with imperfect character and imperfect commitment. I get around a lot with CLE. They send me here and there to stay in touch with schools. And oftentimes when I get to schools, people don't want to talk about the things that are going right so much as they want to talk about the things that are going wrong. And I told my wife recently, with almost frustration, with almost tears, why can't people be big boys and girls for God? Why can't we just grow up? People that are supposed to be characterized by love, you know, God's people, by this shall men know. Where is it? What's going on? And the thing that really gets me frazzed is to look at my own experience. Same lax. L-A-X, L-A-C-K, either one. All right? It's there. When people try to lead on empty, bad things happen in God's family. They just do. Trying to be productive and focused while you're exhausted is like trying to run your automobile down the road without gas in the tank. You see gas in the tank, oil in the lamp, God in the man. Same principles. That's the way it works. I'd like to just share with you some of the utterings that I have done as I taught utterances in prayer. I think my prayer life changed as I taught compared to when I drilled holes in studs around a room like this and pulled wires. Now, one of those prayers that I prayed was, God, just give me what it takes. Because when we're trying to prepare, we don't even know what to prepare for all the time. But I know that my Father has a hand that he can open and satisfy the desires of every living thing. And that's me. And I want access to that hand. So God, give me what it takes. Another prayer would have been, help me to be patient. Because my natural predilection shows a lot of visible demonstration when I get upset. Okay? Maybe that's not you. Maybe you're like that duck in the pond that can be moving along just fine. Everything's calm. But then you get to an aquarium or somehow you get a glimpse of what's going on underneath. And it's going like crazy. That's the kind of person I aspire to be, you know, when all my cogitations and my frustrations and all my whatevers are down under and I'm making progress. But that's not the way I'm naturally. So prayers for patience. Or another prayer that I often prayed is I would imagine my classroom, and I'd imagine where each one's seated. And I could name each one by name in the room. It's one of the reasons that I didn't like to change desks, is because it affected my ability to pray, or at least affected the crutch that I used to remember every student. Another thing I prayed for is a sound mind, healthy body. I don't like to teach when I'm sick. Another thing I prayed for pretty often is something that went a little bit like this, but God, I'm sorry, I can't take this anymore. And I didn't necessarily pray that at 3 o'clock or at noon. I prayed that at 8 o'clock pretty often. And I'm here to report that that was part of preparation to be a teacher. Because when I prayed that prayer, God, I'm sorry, it didn't seem like he was sorry at all. It almost as if he was there smiling, saying, finally, he's where I wanted him. Mm-hmm. All right. It's when we, as was earlier said today, as we stretch our hands to God, that he gives what he has to us. Another prayer, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. There's a lot impregnated in that prayer. Or how about this one? You've probably seen this variety to that prayer, serenity to accept the people I cannot change, courage to change the one I can, and the wisdom to know that that's me. We're talking about preparation. So often it's our own hearts. Well, there's more, perhaps enough said about that, but let's fill in the blanks. If any of you lack wisdom, let him say it. Ask of God that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be
given.
That's a promise. Prepare by using that promise. All right? Not that we are sufficient of ourselves to think anything of ourselves, but our sufficiency is of
God.
That's exactly right. Next one I would say, another area that we need to prepare in is prepare in expectations. And what I'm primarily thinking of there is student expectations. Rather than comment a lot on this, I'm just going to read you a story. This is from Bruce Wilkinson, The Seven Laws of the Learner. I had the privilege of meeting this man in person a few months back. I stood like a rock in a rushing stream of preoccupied Bible college students. It was fall registration, organized chaos. I'd seen it all before many times, but this time, instead of racing around the gymnasium signing up for classes, I watched as students signed up for my classes. It was my first year out of graduate school, and I was just hours away from my debut on the other side of the lectern. Taking a closer look at several of the registration tables, I noticed that I had been assigned Section 1, 2, and 3 of the course called Bible Study Methods. The remaining 5 sections were taught by others. After walking around for 20 minutes or so, I left the gym and headed across the campus toward my office. A well-seasoned faculty member at the college caught up with me and said, Bruce, I just can't believe it. You can't believe what? They gave you section 2, didn't they? Well, yeah, I guess it did. He shook his head in seeming disbelief. I can't believe it. You're the new faculty member, the first year rookie, and they gave you section 2? He had me perplexed. Well, what's so special about section 2? Didn't they tell you that at the faculty orientation? The truth was, I was the only new faculty member that year, so they didn't have a faculty orientation, so I asked him to explain it to me. Section 2 has all the top high school seniors coming into the freshman class, the honors group, cream of the crop, the most outstanding group of students in the whole college. We stopped outside the faculty offices, and he leveled his gaze at me. Bruce, you're not going to believe the difference teaching Section 2. What do you mean, I asked, not knowing whether to feel exhilarated or intimidated. Growing up, I'd never been in a Section 2, I don't think. Motivation, he said, like a team of wild horses straining at the reins. Those kids will just pull it out of you. You're going to love every minute of it. Wow, first-year teacher, I can't believe the luck. As he walked down the sidewalk shaking his head, I was intrigued, to say the least. The next day, Section 1 filed in, and we had a good hour together. Nothing outstanding, just a good give-and-take session with a solid group of young men and women. After break, Section 2 walked in, and I couldn't believe it. He was absolutely right. I could feel the electricity in the air. From the ring of the bell, class just flew by as the teacher and students learned at almost warp speed. It was like stepping on a surfboard and riding the crest of the wave the entire hour. At times, the class interest and desire to learn swept over me with such intensity that I had trouble staying on top of my emotions. Everything seemed different, their questions, their eye contact, their facial expressions, even the way they sat. It was incredible. My colleague was right. These students pulled the best right out of you. Section 3 came in later that day, and I realized in only a few seconds they were just like Section 1. Good, yes, but nowhere near the caliber of Section 2. As the semester progressed, I found myself increasingly grateful to God for leading me into the ministry of teaching. I never felt so challenged and fulfilled, and although I enjoyed all my classes, Section 2 always made my day. As we neared midterms, I found myself walking to a faculty meeting with the academic dean, Dr. Joseph Wong. Well, Bruce, he said, you're at the halfway point of your first year. Honeymoon's over. How do you enjoy college? It's absolutely terrific. It's better than ever imagined. He smiled. That's great to hear. What's your favorite part? Without thinking, I blurted out, Section 2. He raised his eyebrows and stopped walking in order to listen more intently. I thought, you have Section 2? Tell me more. It was my first chance to express my delight and gratitude for the opportunity to teach 30 of the keenest students I had ever encountered. I sung their praises for a couple of minutes as I described the amazing difference between them and the rest of my class. The dean looked thoughtful as I went on and on about this gifted group of young men and women. When I had finished, he said, I'm glad you're having so much success, Bruce, but I do need to tell you something that may surprise you. There is no honors class this year. We canceled it. My mouth went dry. Joe, I said, you've got to be kidding. No, not kidding. Last year, we decided it would be better if we spread those top students throughout all the classes. We thought it would add a little more spark to each of the sections. Dizzy with disbelief, I said, Joe, I'll catch you in a few minutes. I need to go back to my office. I raced back there and dialed the registrar, sure that my colleague was trying to pull something over this rookie. Joyce, I said, I've got Section 2 in Bible study methods, right? That's right, Bruce. I swallowed hard. And Joyce, Section 2 contains all the outstanding students, right? The top freshmen, yes? Well, no, Bruce, we've canceled that program this year. Groaning inwardly, I thanked her and hung up the phone. I couldn't seem to come to grips with what was happening. With reluctance, I reached for my grade book and opened it. I compared the grades of Section 1 and 3 with Section 2. The difference was staggering. I pulled a stack of ungraded papers off my bookshelf. Stacking Section 1 and 3 on top of each other, I compared that pile with the stack from Section 2 by itself. Section 2 had more pages than the other two sections combined. I went through the papers one by one, page by page, and the difference was dramatic. The Section 2 students outshone their peers again and again. That day proved to be one of the most dramatic learning experiences in my life, and I've never quite gotten over it. For the first time, I realized that what I believed about my students made an incredible difference in what they learned in my class. You see, there was no real difference between Sections 1, 2, and 3. It was the same content, the same day of the week, the same pool of 18 and 19-year-old students, not one difference. In fact, never once did I say, now you are Section 2 and your performance should show it. Then how could I explain such a dramatic difference in what those students learned? The only difference was, teacher,
thank you.
right. Because my expectations were so much higher for section two, so was their behavior and learning. I'll never forget sitting back in my chair and saying to myself, I wonder what would have happened if a faculty member had told me that the outstanding students were from section one or three. Would you want a teacher who is terminally dour in their outlook about your abilities? Think about it. Then prepare accordingly. Okay. All right, the next section would just simply be know your students. This is probably the part that I miss most now that I'm not in the classroom anymore. Students are just plain fun to be around. Very enjoyable. There's quite a diverse range of students. And you know, as you learn to know your students, you get more and more effective with them because you learn more and more how you can appeal to their interests. I'm not sure if I should indulge in just telling you about some of the students. Now, maybe I will just a little bit. Some of the students that I've encountered, one was just a difficult learner. Things did not go well for her. And sort of just kind of a little pansy that seemed to get crushed pretty often at school. Well, my heart went out to her, but I really didn't know how to connect. Really didn't. I wasn't sure. I think she was lazy. I wasn't sure how much of that was ability and how much of it was just, you know, laziness. One day we were having art class and we were making slat boxes, kind of like an old potato crate, and we needed to cut out the handles where you can stick your fingers in to pick it up. And as we cut out those handles, there was off fall. You know, the little half moon piece kept dropping off and landing on the ground outside. There she was stacking those pieces together. Oh, come on, you know, get on task. Can't you even be on task during art class? And she was looking at him and looking at him. And finally she said, Mr. Jonathan, can I have these? I was like, duh, yeah. She was so excited about those little pieces. I have no idea what she did with it. She took every single one of them home. But then I began to realize that her way of looking at the world was all through an artist perspective, could we say, or through more of the art and those visuals. And then I began to realize that, how could have I missed it? Right here, it says on her little introduction page in our visitor's book that someday she would like to grow up to be an interior designer or decorator. Okay, well, there we go. If we can learn these things, we can appeal to these things. And we can, maybe if spelling's hard, we can at least make sentences that relate to their interests, okay, as we're giving the spelling test. But as we learn their predilections, their interests, and their likes, and their dislikes, and so on. I had a young man, I absolutely could not connect with him. He just was locked in his own shell. And I think some of it was because he had a very authoritarian father. That's just the way his father didn't know how to do anything different except beat up on children, it seemed. As you can tell, I didn't know the father very well either, but that's just the way it seemed. It just seemed like what he did best was be hard on children. I wanted to get next to this young man, and I realized that this young fella really, really likes diesel engines. He knows all about the new releases that are coming in the pickup trucks, you know, the new models. And I did something that year that unlocked our relationship, and that is I subscribed to Diesel Progress, which is a magazine all about diesels. I don't have any interest in diesels, really. I'd never worked on diesels, really. I know a little bit about them, but certainly not enough to read a magazine. But I kind of forced myself to read that magazine. One day, when I finally got that magazine subscription, I read it. The day it came, the next day, as he was biting into his sandwich, I just sort of casually remarked that I read in Diesel Progress last night that, bam, and we were, it changed everything. He's like, you read Diesel Progress? Oh, yeah, I read Diesel Progress. It was wonderful. It really, really was. Today, I have a relationship with that young man, uncharacteristic of many of my students, simply because I believe I helped to unlock our relationship by learning his predilection, and we made mileage after that. What you could do now, you're thinking, well, what can I do now? Maybe you could send him a postcard now. Hi, Billy. I'm in Oregon right now. There's lots of postcards from around Oregon here. Getting ready to have school. See you in 3 weeks, teacher. Might be interesting to try that. You could get their school records and study them. Don't let that affect your expectations too much, but there is merit in getting the school files and checking them out. All right, let's move on. Know your school. As was already said, schools have culture. It means they have their ways of doing things. Maybe your school gets together once a week and sings as a whole school. Maybe they get together once a week and have recess together as a whole school. Or maybe they have recess together all the time. All these things and many, many thousand more little things make the culture of your school and the culture of your community. It was impressed upon me rather vividly here a while back. I had been visiting at one school. Everything seemed to be going well there. They were using a particular set of curriculum that seemed to be working out. The teachers were happy. The students were on task. It was quiet. It was respectful. It was diligent. Everything just was right. And I thought, wow, you know what? I wouldn't mind sending my own children to that school. I got in my car, drove down the road a little ways, got out the next school. At that next school, they had almost identical set of curriculum. It was almost the same in every way. The teachers were harassed. Yeah. They just were tired. They were maybe harried would be a word for it. And as we chatted with them, they were like, how do you get the students to do the work? Our students are taking homework home and they're not getting it done. Does CLE really expect to get through this course in a year? How? And they mend it. All right, and that's fine. I don't mind hearing that frustration. I don't mind trying to understand where somebody is. Tremendous difference in school culture. The curriculum set was exactly the same, but the results were completely different, and it had to do with school culture. Learn to know, learn to interpret your school culture, and then change what you can. Now, you don't want to come in there and try to reinvent the wheel with a whole bunch of different procedure, perhaps, and school policy. All those things affect school culture, too. But learn to know your school culture. Where are areas that can need encouragement? Of course, cooperate with those things that are just matters of procedure, matters of preference, and so on. School structure is another thing we need to know about our schools. Schools are arranged differently. Some schools have principals. Some schools have a head teacher. Some schools have a school board chairman that's always a principal. All these things vary, and they change how you relate to school a bit. Do you have a go-to person, or is a whole board your go-to group? Is a school patron-sponsored, or is it church-sponsored? It makes a difference. These things you ought to know. You ought to learn. It's part of your preparation. Know your curriculum. There's a lot that could be said about knowing your curriculum. As John said, it can be a little bit daunting when you have a stack of books that you've never been around before. Now what are we going to do? Well, you do it a little bit like you eat an elephant, just one bite at a time. You don't have to learn the whole stack in one whack. Start with one book. Look at the table of contents. Try to understand the scope of what's being studied, the sequence of what's being studied. It makes a little bit difference between what I like to think of as skill subjects like math, language, reading, and the content base like science and history, Bible. We're not necessarily teaching a skill so much as we teach history and science, as we're teaching skills when we're teaching fractions and nouns and verbs and so on. Try to get yourself oriented what type of material you'll need to be presenting and need to be handling. I would say, too, that many of our schools are using conservative Anabaptist curriculum, which is good. The difference between rod and staff and CLE, I'm not intending to put one up higher than the other. I have a high appreciation for both. They're not written the same, especially in the skill subjects, like math, English, language arts, CLE calls it. But the one uses a unit approach, the other uses a spiral approach. You're going to have to package if you're going to make a textbook, you're going to have to package that subject material somehow. It ends up that not only CLE and rod and stamp, but other curriculums will follow this pattern too. I like to think of it this way. If here is a student's level of knowledge and we're trying to get them here, say this represents adjectives. We're moving them from a fourth grade level of understanding in adjectives to a fifth grade level in understanding of adjectives. The unit-based method tends to be more like a ramp that goes from the one to the next. Starts out very easy, might have a lesson on what are adjectives, gets increasingly difficult, more advanced, until we're finishing at the end of the unit of adjectives, doing perhaps the hardest thing, like, well, probably not in fifth grade, but in the seventh grade, they will be diagramming adjective clauses. Pretty tough, right? And then right after that's the review and the test. And after the test, in a unit-based method of packaging material, the reviews will simply be reviewing what was back here with no further consequences on tests. In fact, you could, skip. That's about right. You could about skip the review without having a consequence on other units, say, from a unit on adverbs, because you don't test adverbs when you're testing adjectives and vice versa. Is that making sense? Right? And that works. It works very well. Right? Another method then, which is harder to draw, the spiral method. If anybody wants to come up here and draw a spiral, you're welcome to it. Because I can't draw a spiral very well at all, but I like to think of it like a ramp on a parking garage. Is that a spiral? Someone please say yes. But you kind of go around and around, right? And each time you go around, you're getting higher and higher and higher. And so with the spiral approach, there's more incremental learning with lots of review. And so with CLE in math and language, only 30% of the lesson, roughly 30%, is going to be new material, and then 70% is review. Okay, and it's not like we're studying one set thing so rigidly as we had been describing. And people that are used to this method, like myself, I was schooled in this method, and I taught this method. I began to first look at the spiral approach, and oh, it looks like someone stuck a big stick in there and stirred it up, because it's all messed up. Right? The sequence doesn't seem real anymore. Right? Have no fear. There's been a lot of preparation, a lot of planning that went into the spiral method. And as it turns out, I think the spiral method does actually follow our natural rhythms of learning perhaps more than the unit method. There are some reasons for going and making it more complex, but maybe enough for now. But know your curriculum. Know your schedule. I have some things to say here about personal life and school life. One of the things that I enjoyed about teaching school that I miss now is that school created a schedule and it imposed discipline on me. Right now, it's not so important whether or not I leave exactly at 6:15 or not, and so on. School comes pretty relentlessly. It's pretty daily, and we have to have a personal life schedule, really. I think that it will help you be more effective if you stop and think, what time am I going to leave to go to school every day, if you wait until later to decide what time you're going to leave for school. Well, you might not be in as better a position then, as good of a position then as you are now to decide what time you're going to leave. See, because if you decide what time you're going to leave, you're going to have to decide what time you're going to have to get up. And if you're going to have to decide what time you get up, well, then you probably are going to have to decide what time you're going to go to bed. And if you're going to decide what time you have to go to bed, well, then you have to decide, you see what's happening, all right? And that's good. It's a good discipline. It's a good exercise. And I think that right now would be some good times to set down put down some guidelines about what you want to see in your personal life about schedule. So many things, I believe, go wrong simply because we didn't do the right thing at the right time, or maybe didn't give it enough time. So go ahead and get a little rigid about this. It won't hurt you. It'll help. School life. As it relates to the school life schedule, by all means, you don't have to reinvent the wheel here. Unless you have a brand new school, you will have previous teachers' schedules to borrow from. Even if you are a brand new school, find a school that's similar to your own and get the schedule there. And then you can twist and pull and tweak and make it work. Most teachers in our part of the country are teaching in a school that's small enough that you'll have multiple grades. And you're going to have to fit all this in somehow. So you can budget your time, the number of times you need to know, the number of times you need to have a subject in a week to get through it in a year. That's part of learning to know your textbooks. Do a little bit of math there, calculating, you know, how many times you need to have this in a week and so on to get through it. And then think about it. Get concise enough. Boil it down concise enough. Get it clear enough that you can put it on the students' desks with a piece of contact paper. Not that you have to do that, but I think that we just ought to be that concise and that clear that we could say, this is what we're going to do on Monday, this is what we're going to do on Tuesday, every day of the week. Actually, I think your students would like to have a schedule because they like to know what's coming too. All right, moving on, prepare your records. And I'm bending the definition of records just a little bit here. We're going to talk about some things that perhaps aren't all just teacher records necessarily, but they are things that are recorded at school on paper. You need to have a planner, a teacher's planner. In other words, what are we going to do today? This is why it really helps to teach more than 1 year, because you can go back to the previous year's planner and you can look. I had 16 first days of school as a teacher. And I began to realize what works and what doesn't. And now I could have a first day without doing much planning at all. But it was because I put planning into it beforehand, right? So in your teacher's planner, you write what you're going to assign, what needs to be finished that day, and so on. Teacher's grade book. That suggests some more decisions. What is your school's culture regarding daily grades? Are you going to be taking daily grades? Just taking grades on quizzes and tests, those things I think you best follow what's already in place before you get there. The board will speak into that kind of thing. But you're going to have to record grades somewhere and somehow get that prepared beforehand. Now, oftentimes teachers think, of today's generation, I've noticed that they think they need a computer to get these first two things done. And maybe they do, and maybe they don't. I guess you think now you know what I think. All right. I just think that we spend way too much time getting technology to work for us. You can do all this stuff on paper, and I think you can do it more efficiently on paper. Now, it is true, with grades, you won't get fancy printouts and pie graphs and colored bar graphs and so on. But I'm from the old school. I guess I don't much apologize for that, because my birth year makes it that I'll always be an immigrant to technology. But it bothers me, folks. It really does. I think there's a principle here beyond some of this peripheral stuff about being an immigrant to technology. It bothers me how much time I see, especially young men, goofing on their computer. I mean, you say, well, I'm getting it ready. That's not goofing. Well, what's more important than getting a grade book set up on your computer? I can think of several things pretty quickly. Did you know that the games aren't won by watching the scoreboard? Did you know that? Who's the richest man in America? One of the richest? Not thinking of that. Not Bill Gates, the other guy.
Warren Buffett.
That's right, Warren Buffett. He's the one that said that games are won by players who focus on the playing field. Right, not the scoreboard. And he said that in relation to the stock market. You know, if you're watching the stock market all the time, getting all twitchy, you're not really focusing on the big picture. I don't know more about stocks than that right there, because that's about all I know. Right. But I think there's a principle. If our eyes are glued to the scoreboard, and not only our eyes, but our time is hogged by the school board, we're going to be neglecting some of the more important things. So if you want to get a computer to do these things, that's all fine, that's all right and good. But just remember that there are more important things to be spending your time in. Another record that you should be concerned about as relates to preparation is a school handbook. Your school might not have a handbook. I asked for a handbook when I went to a new school one time, and they laughed, and everybody pointed at one school board member and said, see, and I'm like, what's going on here? Well, the school was supposed to have a handbook, and he was supposed to write it, and it never happened. A school handbook basically just has any policies that I guess we're putting in the handbook. but it may be a resource that your school has that you might not know about. I don't know that it necessarily needs to be anything real fancy. School where I was on the board, we just had a list, a paper, that the secretary was responsible to put anything that was more of a precedent, policy-related precedent. You know, this is something that we want to keep in place at this school into the future. He had to just write those down. And that was our school handbook. Well, would it be nice to know the school precedents that were set in place before you got there? Of course it would. So ask. They might have something, they might not. Another record that is part of preparing would be the curriculum guide. Many schools have a paper somewhere that says what they're going to study when. Especially in multi-grade classrooms where we're overlapping in history and science and Bible and some of that kind of stuff. Right? It's good to have that curriculum guide so you know what you're supposed to teach. Because you might go into the school office or wherever all the books are stored, and boom, there they are. And to make sense of all this can be a little bit frustrating unless you have a paper that says what you're supposed to teach in the 17-18 school year, this one coming up. Another would be a student permanent file record. This is, I think every school should have records of previous grades. This is something I typically did not prepare before school started. I simply added to it. We had a principal at the last school where I taught. He kept, every time there was a new student, he'd get a new file started, have a nice label in that file for that student. And there's stuff in that permanent file record, like report card grades, achievement test grades, going on to point F there, admission forms, parental consent forms, medical records. That I would really, really recommend your school would have in place because you don't know what's going to happen in the course of a year or in the course of a day at school. One time I dismissed the students and thought life was good. Everybody went home. Two families hadn't, and one sixth grade girl, I don't know how she did it, but she cut the calf of her leg in a way that I don't ever want to see again. It was big enough that I could have put this whole marker in and could have disappeared in there. At that point, I was very glad to be able to tell one of the older students, go to the file and get Christina's whole thing. Yeah, yank it out. We're going to the hospital. Right? And they yanked it out. I carried her in to the emergency room. We'll save the descriptions. You can imagine them well enough. I was very glad to have a paper there that said that she is enrolled in this school, and we give the teacher, and my name was on there, whatever, the authority to make decisions that need to be made. I mean, after all, in today's culture, pretty nice to have that with us. So I would definitely recommend having some of that stuff on file. I'd said before, achievement tests, it's good to be able to look back at those achievement tests. I like to be able to, at the end of the year, pull out the previous year's achievement test to compare to see how much academic progress we actually made. Well, if it's going to be in there, someone had to put it in there, right? Let's be sure that you do your part in getting it put in there the year before so that you can prepare with it or the next teacher can prepare with it. All right, now let's talk about preparing to teach. Some of the stuff we've been talking about here really was pretty mundane, pretty much nuts and bolts, and you could probably figure that out on your own, and probably some of the rest of this you could too. And I don't know if you came to this class thinking we were going to talk only about preparing to teach. And now we have a lesson. Tomorrow we're going to have to teach lesson 42 in math. How are we going to do it? Right? But that's what we're going to talk about for the remainder of this class period, preparing to teach. Law 1, of the seven laws of teaching, John Milton Gregory, he says the teacher must be the one who knows the lesson or truth to be taught. All right? And if we don't know intimately the thing that we're going to teach, we're going to be ineffective in our teaching. Right? So it behooves us then to spend enough time in classroom preparation. Right? And if we take that seriously and if we live by it, it means that preparing for tomorrow's lessons are more important than just a lot of things. The one is, it's more important than the volleyball game tonight with the youth. That's what it means if you're a teacher and if you're going to know the lesson, right? It's more important than getting yesterday's lesson's grade computed down to the final percent, right? Leave those papers there until you have the lessons figured out for tomorrow, would be my recommendation. It's far more important than strumming a computer, for crying out loud. Right? Know your lesson, folks. Know your lesson. Whatever it takes to know the lesson. We talked a little bit about a textbook and a course overview. Right? That is important, to know your book well enough that you know where it's headed. But I'm primarily concerned here about daily lesson preparation. And there was the bell. I wanted to spend more time on this than what we're going to end up with to spend. But this is a real crash course on daily lesson preparation. But I really think that this is about the sum of things in a nutshell. Right? If you can identify the objectives, first of all, what is this lesson teaching? If it's teaching a student how to say "ah" as an apple, well, then that's what you prepare to teach. You prepare to teach how to form the mouth. You prepare to teach everything about "ah." All right? Be sure you know what the lesson is teaching. It's actually very simple. Then step number two is plan the lead-in. Right? And the lead-in, it really amounts to review. Right? So if I'm going to teach a lesson on adding mixed fractions, and the students haven't never before had added mixed fractions, such would be 2 1/2 plus 1 3/4. That would be an example of a mixed fraction. Well, then we need to think about what are some concepts that we need to understand to be able to get to this lesson today. And so a very good lead in a lesson like that would just be adding, the example I gave was 2 1/2 and 1 3/4. Learn how to add, or review how to add the half and the 3/4, right? And then today's lesson, really, all you're doing is learning, is adding on the 2 and the 1. Okay? So what we're doing is we're in the review, we're actually reinforcing the skills that are needed to learn the lesson today. Right? If you can identify that, especially in those skills-based lessons, which are going to take a lot of teaching, as in teaching a process, identify what processes, what skills, what were they doing up to this point that's required to do this lesson? And then if you use that for the review, for the lead-in, to know today's lesson, so much of it depends on simply knowing well what they knew before. Now we need to finish. Emphasize the minimums for mastery. If you want to know more about minimums for mastery, read this book, The 7 Laws of the Learner. Bruce Wilkinson is the one that coined the phrase minimums for mastery. He says every lesson you need to be able to reduce to maximum of 3 things that they need to know. Skills-based subjects, again. Once you can identify what are the 3 things they need to know to master that lesson, that's the minimums for mastery. And then we focus on those things in particular and do it all the night before. Now, the takeaway, the 3 most important words to a painter, a pilot, or a chef are, you know what. It's easy as 1, 2, 3. That's it. God bless. Oh, I missed a part. Is that on your paper too? Good news, you get to choose. Choose well. Choose well.